Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's much of the negative image of Ulysses S. Grant that has prevailed over time. A mediocre student, a drunk, a crude military strategist. His reputation as victorious Civil War general all but destroyed by the corruption that marred his presidency. But her new biography brings a different side to the fore: moral courage, humility, and a range of life experience unknown to most contemporary candidates. This hour, On Point biographer Ronald C. White on Ulysses S. Grant. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you know of Ulysses S. Grant beyond the rumpled, cigar-smoking photos? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Ronald C. White, historian and fellow at the Huntington Library in San Marino County, California. San Marino, I should say. Senior fellow at the Trinity Forum in Washington, D.C. He's written three books on Abraham Lincoln, including the bestseller A. Lincoln, a biography. His new book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Ronald White, Ron, welcome to On Point.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
What's the stereotype, I guess, at this point, image of Ulysses S. Grant that you are, in many ways, writing against in this biography?
Well, it's really a caricature that he is the wonderful Civil War general, but then fails as a president, especially his second term, which are beset with scandals. I think he's due for an upgrade in the 21st century.
Born in 1822, dies in 1885. I want to dive into many parts of this, but for those who were not good in their history of the 19th century, give us the thumbnail sketch of his life, Ron. Take your time.
He was born on the Ohio frontier, 1822, grew up there. He was saddled with the name Ulysses. His boyhood chums called him Useless. He entered West Point at age 17, 5 feet tall, 117 pounds, a shy boy. Finished only 21st out of 39 in his West Point class, and that saddled him with what some have called a kind of a lightweight in terms of intellectual ability. He was posted to Jefferson Barracks, the largest barracks in St. Louis as people were traveling west. There he met the sister of his senior roommate, Julia Dent, and they became wonderful lifelong partners, a tremendous marriage. He participated in the war with Mexico, was posted to Michigan and New York, and then out to the Pacific coast, where he had to leave Julia pregnant with their second child behind. There he fell into loneliness, despair, and drinking, and finally resigned from the Army in 1854. He went back to live in the shadow of Julia's father, a strident pro-slavery person in St. Louis, and struggled for the next 7 years, the last year serving under his younger brother in the family leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, when the Civil War broke out. And everything changed, and his career began to move forward very quickly.
I have some tape here. This is from a letter that he wrote to Julia Dent, his much-loved wife. He was able to, he went off to war the first time, the Mexican-American War, and he's writing to her here in 1847 from Mexico. This is from PBS American Experience.
My dearest Julia, some of the hardest-fought battles that the world has ever witnessed have taken place, and the most astonishing victories have crowned the American arms. But dearly have they paid for it. The loss of officers and men is frightful. I'm getting very tired of this war, and particularly of being separated from one I love so much.
With all the PBS music in the background, but there we hear Ulysses S. Grant, who became known in the Civil War as, at least in the South, as a Union general who would just churn the casualties into the maw of war, shocked there in Mexico at the carnage of war.
Yes, this was his first encounter with it, and it did shock him. He wondered about his own bravery. What you read is so remarkable because dear Julia kept all of his letters, and the man who was shy, often not willing to express his feelings in public discourse, shared with Julia his deepest feelings, and I call this the pure gold of trying to find the man Ulysses S. Grant.
You say he was an introvert, or you give that impression anyway, before that word was in wide usage. What do you see?
Well, Susan Cain wrote a wonderful book several years ago called Quiet, and it really struck me as she began to describe who are the introverts today. Extroverts win. But when she began to describe the qualities of what it meant to be an introvert, I said, I think she's talking about Grant, someone who is very quiet, often a good listener, not a good speaker, but willing to put one's thoughts into writing. All of these qualities, he was called the quiet man, and I tried to discern what does it mean that he's the quiet man. Those are qualities we don't always appreciate today, but they were qualities that were actually quite respected in his day.
But Lincoln saw in him a fighter. Take us into his Civil War service, his rapid rise there, and the kind of general he became.
Yes, he began early in the Civil War. He was given command of troops in Missouri, and then the first big battle was at Fort Donelson in Tennessee. There he overcame quite a strong Confederate defense. When he was asked what would the terms be for surrender, his former roommate, Simon Bolivar Buckner, asked the terms. Grant responded, "Unconditional surrender." And he quickly gained the nickname U.S. was now Unconditional Surrender Grant. An illustrator pictured him smoking a cigar, and after the battle he received 11,000 boxes of cigars from respectful and appreciative Americans. He went on to win at Shiloh, even though he was surprised, we have to admit, on the first day, and then to Vicksburg, and then to Chattanooga, and then Abraham Lincoln calls him to Washington. They'd never met. And gives him command of all the Union armies, remembering that the previous commanders of the Union armies had all failed, had all disappointed. But now Grant, the Western man, is given command in 1864.
I want to come back and look at all of that, but it was he who ultimately accepted the surrender of Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. And you remind us of how he was recalled, even in a South that was tough on him in many ways, for that gracious surrender setting, he was long remembered and extolled even in the South.
That's right, Tom. He was called the Hero of Appomattox because he offered a very magnanimous peace term to Robert E. Lee, allowing Robert E. Lee's men to keep their horses, even their arms, to go back to be farmers. And when his men initially wanted to cheer and fire off their guns, Grant stopped all of that and said, no. These who once were our enemy are now our brothers again. And for that, he did receive the warmth and appreciation of people in the South.
The New Orleans Times Democrat writing, "Vanquished by his arms in his chivalric kindness, we were doubly vanquished at Appomattox." There, in admiring terms. And for a time, he was absolutely hailed as the war hero. I mean, everywhere he went, you write about people just standing up and shouting and cheering and singing.
Grant, 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 they would cheer. And that actually became a problem when Andrew Johnson succeeded to the presidency after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. It quickly became apparent that Johnson was not a popular figure, and Grant was the popular figure. And yet he tried very much. He was a deferential person. I like to use almost a sports metaphor. Mm. He didn't seek gain. He let the gains come to him. He let the Civil War generalship come to him. He let the presidency come to him. I think this is one of the most admiring portraits of him, and we see it often in quite contrast to today's politics.
What kind of politician was he who was so quiet? How did that work in American politics in that era?
Initially, he was a non-politician. He did not believe that was the role of a military general. And he had actually established his headquarters outside of Washington. He didn't want to be influenced by either the president or Congress. Kind of a funny story is that when Lincoln begins to have this enormous respect for Grant, and Grant is putting out his plans for what's called the Overland Campaign, Lincoln said to him, "Don't tell me your plans. I can't keep secrets. Don't tell me what they are. I just trust you to carry them out." And so after the war, though, as he began to get more involved with Congress, he recognized that this was a political struggle. especially the struggle for what kind of nation it would be, and ultimately the struggle for would the African Americans freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, would they be allowed to take their full place as citizens in this reunited Union?
You see him as a fighter there for that. You see him in opposition to the Ku Klux Klan. You see him remaking the American relationship to some extent with Native Americans, but ultimately so dogged by a reputation for corruption in his second term, around his administration anyway.
Yes, the second term, and we might be reminded that he was the only president elected to serve two consecutive terms between Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson. But the second term, he was dogged by scandals. No one ever blamed him as a person himself full of scandal. What they did blame him for, and there's some proof for this or some evidence of this, is he took his eye off the ball. The enigma of his presidency is how could he be such a good judge of character in the military, but not such a good judge of character in politics. However, I wish to say the scandals should not mar our vision of what he accomplished as president.
The hero of battles renowned. He has won the bright laurel, its garland he wears, and his fame through the world we will sound. Yes, hail, patriot soldier, we'll welcome you home when strife and rebellion.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the American president Ulysses S. Grant with Ronald C. White, his biographer. The new book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. You can join us this hour. Do you know this history? Do you have the famous image in mind, the rumpled General Grant with the cigar? 11,000 boxes sent to him by Americans at one point, Ron White tells us. And do you picture him as the hero of Appomattox, accepting the surrender from Robert E. Lee? Do you see him through the words of Abraham Lincoln, I need this man, he fights? What's your understanding of Ulysses S. Grant? Ronald White mentioned Shiloh. Of course, he was the commander there. This was 1862, and rebels burst out of the woods. Grant's army was camped on the Tennessee River. Surprise attack on the Union Army, 2 days of fighting. And remember the scale of this Civil War, 2 days of fighting, 24,000 casualties. Here's an excerpt from Grant's personal memoirs written in 1885, this reading from the PBS series American Experience.
I saw an open field in our possession, so covered with dead that it would have been possible to walk across the clearing in any direction, stepping on dead bodies without a foot touching the ground.
It was unbelievable carnage. Ron White is with us from Los Angeles. American Ulysses is the book, and Ron calls for you. Carol in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I was going to say, I'm just reading Grant's memoirs right now, and I really appreciate this program.
Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. He wrote those memoirs as he, in a kind of a race against time, he was dying at the time. What do you make of them, Carol?
Well, his writing is a model of clarity and economy. Anyone who teaches English should offer this to their students. It's like clear running water to read him. It's beautiful writing. And, you know, this man taught himself algebra, who everyone thinks was a poor student. Have you ever taught yourself algebra?
No, I have not. No, I have not. No, I have not.
The thing that stood out most for me in his memoirs was what a deep political thinker he was. He decried the Mexican War as an imperialist act. And he talked about the great mass of Confederate soldiers being dirt poor farmers. And he said they, too, needed emancipation,
yeah.
Which is amazing class consciousness for the time.
Yes. celebrated memoirs, Carolyn. I'm glad you raised both those angles on them. I mean, remind us of this run. Part of the reason, the explanation he gave for his poor performance or mediocre performance at West Point was that he was reading novels all the time. This was a man who was in love with novels at a time when maybe that wasn't the number one interest of a lot of young men on the frontier. And his memoirs absolutely celebrated for that clear running water prose, Carol reminds us of. Mark Twain very much involved in bringing those memoirs to the public.
Yes, thank you, Carol, for your comment. One of the first surprises to me, revelations, was when Grant says in his memoirs about his performance at West Point, "I must apologize. I spent most of my time reading novels." Well, I spent a week at West Point early on, and I said, why did he apologize? Well, novels were not highly regarded. The libraries didn't even carry them. But we all know that great writers are invariably great readers. And so I wanted to know, he tells us in many ways, what did he read? And I think that's part of the hidden story of Grant, the kind of literary, imaginative, intellectual quality of him that has been overlooked or underplayed.
Dip in there where Carol dips in. The imperialism of the Mexican-American War, what were his thoughts on that war? He had a special love for Mexico, but take us into the thinking that was forged in that experience.
He did. He crossed the boundary, the Rio Grande, into Mexico, but most of the soldiers only saw poor Mexicans. They decried them. They saw this poor country. He fell in love with it, with the people, with the language. He learned some Spanish, the culture. And then he saw this huge army overcoming this poor army. And he did say later on this was the worst expression of military might the United States had ever exercised, and decried the war with Mexico.
And his thoughts on the white population of the South, the poor white population, class consciousness, Carol reads in his memoirs.
He had a great love for the people of the South. He did not buy again into the stereotypes or caricatures. And the further South he traveled, he both had an experience of empathy for the poor whites who he felt were really not the perpetrators of this war, but even more so for the slaves who made their way into the Union lines. Surprisingly, again, although born into an anti-slavery family, he said of himself he was really not anti-slavery until the experience of the Civil War, and that changed his whole attitude towards African Americans, and he would grow to be one of their main defenders.
Post-war, he may have had sympathy for the lower class of economic class of whites in the South, but the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, he was very fierce against.
Yes, when he ascended to the presidency in 1869, at first he trusted that the ballot would be the answer to the problems for African Americans. But by 1871, he realized that the ballot, there was voter suppression. Voter suppression was taking place in 1871. And when the Ku Klux Klan attempted to be prosecuted in the local or state courts, invariably the prosecutions were never carried through. So against the advice of his own cabinet, against the retreat of his own Republican Party, Grant steps forward to be a fierce defender of the rights of African Americans to vote against the Allies, the Democratic Party, and the Ku Klux Klan, whose main goal was to suppress that vote.
And what was his success in that, or lack thereof?
Initially, he was quite successful. I mean, the vote – this is an unknown story also. We think of Barack Obama as the first president to win with a non-white majority. Actually, Ulysses S. Grant was the first president to win election with a non-white majority. He only won the 1868 election by the vote of 400,000 African Americans. So he stepped forward to defend their vote and was moderately successful by imposing the federal government and the federal army and federal prosecutors. Again, how ingenious. He hired as his attorney general a Southerner. He hired as the first solicitor general a Southerner, but both opposed to slavery. Ultimately, as the war went forward and as Reconstruction went on, even the gains that he made against the Ku Klux Klan were undone.
Ron White, lots of callers for you. Belfast, Maine, Steve is calling. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I was curious. In college, my history advisor was William Catton, who was Bruce Catton's son. I've heard a lot of history about Ulysses Grant, because he was the author of U.S. Grant and the American Military Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I was very struck by is that Grant was the first military officer to basically sew his three stars onto a private's uniform jacket, and essentially set off a whole revolt against fancy military wear. And sort of in World War II, you would see Eisenhower wearing a private's jacket, his Ike jacket, with five stars on it.
Yep.
And the antithesis of that was Patton, who still continued to dress up like a military peacock. But one thing was one of the things that used to be known about Grant was that he was considering annexing either Hispaniola or Cuba to resettle emancipated slaves. And I wonder if that's still considered to be true.
Hispaniola as in Dominican Republic?
Yes.
Ron?
Well, thanks, Steve, first of all, for your kudos to Bruce Catton, who's just a marvelous writer and does help the beginning of the restoration of Grant, the Civil War general. To your second point, he was involved in the annexation of what at the time was called Santo Domingo. And it looks to us from our vantage point that this seemed to be expansionist or imperialist. He didn't, and many did not see it that way. It also seemed to be, perhaps this was a way, he talked about this, that might be a place where African Americans could live. Well, how terrible is that? But the most fascinating thing was when he asked Congress to appoint a committee to reexamine this issue, he appointed the greatest African American of the day, Frederick Douglass, to be his secretary of that commission. And so we might say this was an effort that he should not have pushed so far. But it was part of his foreign policy, probably the foreign policy that is least respected today.
And what came of it, that push?
What came of it was that it was ultimately defeated by the Senate, and so it did not go forward.
And can you vouch for his military wear innovations there? Did he indeed bring it down to the sort of common soldier's look with more stars on the shoulder?
Oh, yes. Thank you again, Steve, for that comment. He was known to wear a private's uniform with only the three stars on his shoulder. When he served in the war with Mexico, he had the two leading generals offered two contrasting positions of leadership. Winfield Scott was all fuss and feathers, sort of what you describe as Patton, everything on his uniform. Zachary Taylor, on the other hand, was very common. And Grant was drawn to Taylor, and this was what he wanted to be, and this is why soldiers so respected him, that he did not want to place himself above them. They called him self-effacing. We might call him a person of humility. And this won his way with the men that he served.
We know those photos of him sort of rumpled, not grand-looking. I mean, the way people allow themselves or wanted to be photographed in that era is simply different from ours in any case. But what do you take from the photos of the rumpled Grant with cigar, Ron?
Well, I think it says something about his own self-identity. Early on when he was starting to get into the war, he wrote the first letter before he did so to his father, and he said, "I will not participate with those trading military men who are seeking advantage." When he runs for president, he tells Sherman, "I will not participate with the trading politicians." His self-identity was to be a person of the people. When he takes his world tour, we haven't even had a chance to
mm-hmm.
talk about that.
We will.
He arrives in England, and people expect him to be this grand person with medals on his chest and an entourage. That's not who he sees himself. He is a common person, one among many, and this is why people didn't simply appreciate him. They really loved him in his day.
Let's go to New York, Jamestown, New York. Barbara's calling. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been telling people for years that General Grant is my favorite general, and I think that if he had been put in command early in the war, although there was high casualty rate during some of his battles, I think overall there would have been a much lower casualty rate for the war.
Ron, what
thank you. Well, thank you, Barbara. You really bring up an important conversation point, and that is casualty rates. For the longest time, Tom, when you introduced the program, you mm-hmm. talked about the lost cause, the suggestion that the better side lost, and one reason they lost was this butcher Grant, so the story goes, who had much higher casualty rates. We now know, all the leading Civil War historians would tell us, that actually Grant's casualty rates were lower than Robert E. Lee. And therefore, he, except with a mighty exception perhaps of the Battle of Cold Harbor, he did not heedlessly throw his men into battle and cause this enormous loss of life. Yes, this was a hard war, but the hard war would then be followed by what he and Lincoln would call a soft peace.
What was his command style? Did he have a characteristic vector of strategy that made him successful?
Well, most interestingly, today I'm going to be with General David Petraeus. We're doing an event in Los Angeles, an event in New York, and mm-hmm. I'm learning from him. General Petraeus believes Grant is by far the greatest American general. He's the only one, General Petraeus would say, who gets an A-plus in the three major categories by which one would judge a general. First is strategic, the overall sense of the strategic plan. The second is operational. By the end of the war, Grant was really leading five armies. And third is tactical. What do you do in a specific battle? What do you do at Mosul, for example? And that all the other generals, MacArthur, Eisenhower, you can George Washington, the whole list, they're good in maybe two of the three. But only Grant, according to General David Petraeus, is good in all three. That's what makes him the greatest general in American history.
Did he indeed just overwhelm the South with numbers and materiel or something else?
He had greater numbers and greater material. One cannot discount that. But after the Battle of the Wilderness, the first great battle of the Overland Campaign of the spring of 1864, Abraham Lincoln said of Grant, it is his pertinacity or his determination that wins. He had the ability to coordinate these five armies. Remember that before the Civil War, the largest American army that had ever fought in the war with Mexico, it was 14,000 men. Now Grant's commanding an army of 200,000 men at once, and he has the ability to coordinate these. They must fight together. Previously, they had been fighting separate battles. He's going to coordinate their efforts.
Steve in Montreal, Wisconsin. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. A question, and I thought I'd read a little bit about Grant, and I recently purchased a book. I'll wave it over the phone here. When General Grant expelled the Jews, and his Order 11 kicked all the Jews out of his military area. You know, these were primarily business people, and he had issues with smuggling, and this apparently was a people, they were immigrants, and maybe they dressed a little different, but nobody ever mentioned anything about this.
Steve, our time is short before the break. Let me give it to Ron Wright. Ron, what happened there?
Steve, yes, you're correct. What Julia called that obnoxious order in December of 1862, worried that all these traitors were aiding the Confederates, he did offer—
By selling cotton into the North?
Selling cotton and supplies. Mm-hmm. He did offer an order, Order Number 11, expelling the Jews. Ultimately, this order was overturned by Abraham Lincoln.
Expelling from what area, Ron? Remind us.
From the far southern part of Confederacy.
Okay.
Down in Mississippi and mm-hmm. Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Also, though, his father was involved in this. He was the employee of a Jewish firm from Cincinnati. And so Grant was just furious that his father was involved in this really illegal trade representing a Jewish firm.
You mean his own father was involved in kind of smuggling
his
cotton
own father
and goods
back? Yes,
well, his son's fighting the war? Okay.
But what we need to know is, quickly, Jonathan Sarna's wonderful book, When Grant Expelled the Jews, Sarna, our leading American Jewish historian, tells us that Grant became extremely repentant for this and in his administration appointed more Jews than any American president to that time.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Wonder Capital, asking what if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time. Introducing Wonder Capital, the award-winning investment platform that allows individuals to invest in solar energy projects across the U.S. Wonder's online investment platform allows you to earn up to 8.5% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And best of all, Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/onpoint. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the American president, Ulysses S. Grant, today. Of course, president, great general, Union general of the Civil War. Ronald C. White has written a new biography, American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. And I have to say, the span of what a life might entail in this life, in those days, just remarkable. From a frontier boyhood, Ulysses S. Grant, he says, not a hunter, not prone to kill, but then, of course, in the Civil War, great, great numbers of casualties under his command, under commands on both sides, Ronald White reminds us. During the war, 1864, Grant determined to crush Robert E. Lee and his Army of Northern Virginia at any cost. The battles of the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, Siege of Petersburg effectively destroyed the rebel army that year. Grant lost 44,000 men. Here's a reading of his letter written to his wife, Julia, dated May 13th, 1864, from Spotsylvania, from the American Experience, PBS.
Dear Julia, the world has never seen so bloody or so protracted a battle as the one being fought, and I hope never will again.
And on went that war, but not for so long. Aaron writes to us, Ron, the Civil War birthed many myths of grandeur and character assassination. She says it sounds like you're retrieving Grant's legacy from the ash heap. Why did his detractors go at him so hard in the aftermath of the war?
This is part of the larger lost cause, the idea of restoring the South. We see it in the movie Gone with the Wind. We see it even in the movie Gods and Generals. And there had to be an antagonist, and the antagonist was Grant, and the protagonist was Robert E. Lee. And so without really taking the time to understand who Grant is, they simply pictured him as the butcher, and that view persisted for many, many years. We even had the Civil War being taught in northern universities, but often by southern professors. So all the way into the early 20th century, that view was one view of Grant.
I mean, but you remind us that there was another view, that you had medallions struck in those days of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant on the same coin or medallion, then Teddy Roosevelt seeing those as the great three. But you've got this famous quote from his contemporary, Grant's contemporary, Henry Adams. So venomous. He says, the progress of evolution from President Washington to President Grant was alone evidence to upset Darwin. What was that about?
It's about Henry Adams. Henry Adams is a kind of a jilted person of a famous family, and so he wants to take after not simply Grant but others. If I may pick up your earlier kind of comment here, mm-hmm. let me read from Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. 1900. Mightiest among the mighty dead loom the three great figures of Washington, Lincoln, and Grant. But Roosevelt goes on to say, of second rank are Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and Andrew Jackson.
So wow, not bad.
Quite an audience, when I read this to them, they say, what? How? You know, that's Theodore Roosevelt, 1900.
Wow, amazing. We have no less than Ulysses calling from Pageland, South Carolina. Ulysses, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Pretty well. Where'd you get that name, Ulysses?
My mother actually named me that. Well, actually, it was a strange story. For a while, my mother didn't know what to name me, and my aunt Patricia Tyson, she decided that would be a great name for me.
Bravo! It's a pretty majestic. What's your comment or question, Ulysses?
Well, for years, I felt a lot of rhetoric behind having a name like that because a lot of people had a lot of stereotypes about Mr. Grant, saying that he was a racist drunk. But, you know, I'm actually glad you guys had this segment. I just wanted to call and say that because I never knew he actually – well, the question is, would you consider him an abolitionist?
Abolitionists would be those who wanted to argue for immediate abolition. He would be anti-slavery. And more so as he became president. Of course, by then the slaves had been freed. And then the question was, would these freed slaves enjoy their decreed civil rights. And the surprising story was of how his own Republican Party began to retreat from this, and Grant, against the counsel of his own cabinet, stands up for African Americans squarely, surely, and therefore that's how he won their great gratitude.
That evolution, you say he came to be a fiercely critical of slavery, and it happened in war, in direct observation? I mean, he, as you point out, his father-in-law had slaves. I've got listeners writing here to us that Grant himself for some short time owned a slave. Was the last, is that true, the last president who owned a slave?
Grant did own a slave. If listeners are privileged to go someday to the wonderful Park Service U.S. Grant National Historic Site near St. Louis, they begin their film with the remarkable story of Grant deciding to free the only slave he had, which had been given to him by his father-in-law, who he needed at first, he thought, to help on the farm. So he manumits or frees William in 1859. He could have received $1,000 for William, at least. He needed that money desperately. He was failing economically, but he freed William.
Wow.
He never speaks about that, but that's a remarkable act in 1859.
$1,000 in 1859. There's an act of what he admired, I guess, and spoke of, moral courage, something Abraham Lincoln also spoke to.
Yes, physical courage, he said, is one thing, but moral courage, to do the right thing, knowing that you have, there's an internal moral compass, which I think Grant understood, to do what was right, even when those around him urged him to do something else.
Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a bit hoarse, so I hope you'll forgive that.
Okay. Yeah, we got it.
This is a very non-militaristic comment about Grant. I am a great admirer of the Japanese classical drama called N-O-H.
Sure.
It's a 600-year-old form. When Grant was in Japan, the Japanese presented an evening of no plays for him. Mm-hmm. Each play is about an hour long. There are usually three plays. They did so with trepidation because they knew it was an old-fashioned form, and with the influx of Western influence, they were a little ashamed of the old classical stuff. However, his response was incredibly positive, and he told them never to let this form die. And most dramatic historians believe that if it weren't for Grant, No might have disappeared completely from the Japanese cultural scene. When a Japanese troupe came to Boston some years ago, very brilliantly, they did a whole program of the same plays that Grant saw on that evening. And I went to that, and it was absolutely thrilling to have that connection and to feel that he had saved one of the great dramatic forms of the world.
Alan, let us pick it up. Very austere, no theater. Maybe, Ron, you can put us in that setting, but step back for a moment first and get us there. This world tour of Grant's, kind of without precedent, changing the American sense of the world or how our prominent citizens would act in it. Put us on the world tour. We can end up in Japan.
First, Alan, thank you. I did not know that story. I'm grateful to you for informing me. Yes, Grant always loved to travel. He wanted to go to new places, discover new things. Travel for him was educational. He simply wanted to take a trip with Julia and their youngest son. So they arrived in Liverpool, England.
What year are we talking now?
1877, right at the end of his two terms as president. Mm-hmm. And to his great surprise, he was greeted as an American hero. But a different kind of hero. The Times of London had said when Lincoln gave his second inaugural address, if this had been offered by any other American, it would have been arrogant. Many people in England viewed Americans as arrogant. Mm. And so Grant broke that mold. Then the tour continued. He went to Berlin, for example, and he walked out of his hotel without an entourage, without a carriage, with no medals on his chest, and met with Bismarck. He continued the tour all the way to China, where the ruler of China asked if he would be willing to intercede and actually mediate a dispute they had with the Japanese over a set of islands. When he arrived in Japan, if I could pick up on your comment, Alan, of Grant's appreciation, he told both the Japanese and the Chinese, do not let the Europeans into your country. Do not let them tell you what to do. You have your own traditions, which I respect. And then he went further to say, and I hope that America will always treat you with justice.
a forward thinker in at sort of the height of the era of imperialism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Amazing story. Karen, in no less than Galena, Illinois, where Ulysses S. Grant was, of course, kind of in his fallow years before the war. Karen, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm so excited about this book. In Galena, Grant is celebrated every day. We have the home that he lived in when he returned from the war, which was given to him by the town, and that's open to the public. And I docent in the Washburn House, which is where Grant was sitting the night of his election, and Ilya Washburn, the congressman, had put a telegraph in his home. And while 15 prominent men in the community were pacing nervously, Grant sat next to the fireplace in a chair, calmly smoking his cigar. And when we give a tour of the house, we sometimes remind people that he was also very calm during the battles.
Oh, I love it, Karen. You put us right there, right up in the most northwest corner of Illinois, or almost up there in Dubuque, sitting there on the night of his election. It's the greatness, Ron, of call-in radio. Galena is right here in our ear. What do you take from it, Ron?
Karen, beautiful Galena. What a lovely city, beautifully restored to the way it looked in the 19th century. Karen, I've also actually been in the original home there up on the hill, which is not in public property now. Yes, you capture, Karen, Grant very well, calm, whether it's in the battle or whether it's for the presidency, because, you see, he did not seek the presidency. The presidency came to him, and this made all the difference in the world. He didn't have to run as this what he called trading politician. And this, I think the publisher published my book a month before our presidential election. It's a wonderful contrast to what politicians sometimes, unfortunately, seem like today.
Speak to the reputation for corruption that dogged his second term and how that came to be and what you take from it.
Yes, no doubt the corruption was present throughout his second term, both of previous aides who in the military who now became his aides, Orville Babcock, actually, who married a woman from Galena, was probably the chief person here. Grant could not believe that Babcock had been corrupted by the power of Washington. It surely was the case that he was.
What kind of corruption was it? What was he involved in?
Well, in this particular one, he was involved in what was called the whiskey scandals. And this is where distillers were producing whiskey in Chicago and Milwaukee and St. Louis, and they were underestimating what they had produced so that they did not have to pay taxes. And there was a collusion among all of these people. But they couldn't have made this happen without someone in an inner circle, and that was Babcock. But also persons who were then appointed to his cabinet. Oh, maybe we could say he didn't know them too well, but these were also corrupt individuals. And Grant needs to be held accountable, the fact that he didn't keep his eye closely enough on these persons and what their activities were.
Did he turn a blind eye? Was he implicated in that way, or was he simply gullible or unaware? I mean, this is a savvy man, not a naive person.
This is the enigma. I think he is a savvy man. He was sometimes unaware. Perhaps he was too distant from the management of these particular individuals. Even in the military, he was willing to let his second-in-command officers he wasn't a micromanager. And so these people went their own way, and he was slow to see and even slower to admit what was going on.
One more call here. Joe in Cleveland, Ohio. Joe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
How's it going?
Good.
Two quick questions, both relating to Mexico. One is, so prior to going to Mexico, Grant had talked about wanting to become a math professor at some college somewhere.
Yes.
But then after the war, there seems to be no mention of any consideration of anything other than military life. And I'm just curious if that was a direct result of his experience. Was there like a gene that switched on that all of a sudden there was a he kind of had a taste for that life. And the second, briefly, is in his memoirs, he seems to see the Civil War as kind of a natural consequence of the Mexican War. And I was just wondering, is there any historical truth to that, if there was kind of an inevitability of after that war happened and the annexation of Texas, was the Civil War kind of almost inevitable?
Ron?
Well, let me start with the second part of your comment or question first. Yes, in many ways, during the period before the war with Mexico, there was a great interest in the South of, as they saw perhaps the door closing on slavery, of expanding slavery south. And so expanding into Mexico was certainly a strong possibility. I believe the war with Mexico, to your first point, is part of the formation of Grant. He's not sure. He doesn't really want to go to West Point. His father suggests that that's what he does, and boys in the 19th century acceded to their father's wishes. West Point was a great engineering school. But once he gets into the war with Mexico, he discovers, in a sense, his own latent leadership abilities. And he works very well with volunteers. Many West Pointers were snubbed their noses at volunteers. And so he begins to discover his own power. And now the camaraderie, I think that's a key factor, of persons that he respects. And so, of course, the war with Mexico, you had Southerners and Northerners fighting side by side. Grant will return from the war with Mexico to marry Julia. And all three men who stand up with him at the wedding are from the South. All three will fight in the Confederacy.
We've just got a minute, Ron. What would you wish for from the Grant wardrobe for traits in American leadership today that we might have too little of?
Let the offices come to the person. Have a transparent kind of self-effacing instead of a me first. Be willing to see yourself as part of a larger community. It's not the big me personality. Become a better listener and not simply a talker.
Ronald C. White. His new biography is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. You can read an excerpt of American Ulysses at our website, onpointradio.org. You're talking with General Petraeus later today. Good luck with that. Should be interesting in light of Ulysses S. Grant. Thank you so much for being with us this hour, Ron.
Thank you, Tom. My privilege.
It's terrific to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Caitlin O'Keefe, Maeve Pajess, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Haliba Gikandi and Weiwa Lee. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.